Now, is there anything before we get started, anything that you want to try and avoid or stay away from?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I've got a cup of tea in my left hand because I've got this Skype microphone covering the right side of my face. If I lift up my cup of tea with my right hand, I'm going to knock it and spill it all over me. So I'm going to really avoid okay. drinking my tea with my right hand.
Hi guys, it's Dan here at Glen Office. I just want to say thanks for everything you're doing with the Something Beautiful podcast. I've been a bit of an intermittent listener. I just spent the last week or so catching up on some of the back issues. And I just want to thank you for everything. Love the advent, the many advent issues that you had. Love to, JD, your chat with Steve Knight. Interesting the parallels that were drawn also by Thomas and Stuart in the after chat. About the editing and all our kind of hatred of actually editing stuff, and drew it to my own mind that, you know, I always kind of, if I'm reading someone else's articles, I'll always spot a spelling mistake or a typo or something that's wrong with it. But if I'm doing my own, however many times I read it, I'll always miss something. And couldn't help but be drawn to the text and scripture when, you know, so often we look for the speck in a brother's eye, but we missed the huge plank in our own eye. And so thanks for just bringing that analogy and just bringing it more to my mind that I need to look more at what I'm doing before I criticize what other people are doing. So, just want to say thanks for all you're doing and really appreciate the ministry, and I just want to encourage you in it. Thanks, guys, and God bless you all.
Well, it's Thomas here. It's episode 5 of the second volume of Something Beautiful podcasts. I've managed to get out of my bed of sickness to join Stuart Cutler today with a quick chat with regards to the interview JD did with Andrew Jones, a.k.a. the tall, skinny Kiwi. So how are you, Stuart?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm sore. I'm surprised that you're saying you're well after me showing you my scars via Skype. It's not a pleasant one, and unfortunately the worst thing about this is I can't actually laugh. It is physically extremely sore for me to laugh, so that's caused my recuperation's been a bit dull. I've been sitting in my backside for a week, and I've got another 3 weeks of sitting in my backside, so hopefully I'll get better soon. It's just I've got a scar at the top of my belly, a scar at my belly button, and two scars at my right side, who have went in and footered about with me to take out my gallbladder. So I'm rather sore, but I appreciate all the support. As you've probably seen and read in the blog, just felt really connected, really connected with everybody, and appreciate everybody's thoughts and prayers and contact. I've had visits and cards and emails and texts and tweets and Facebook, and I have to say I'm really grateful to the hospital for allowing me to use my iPhone. I was surprised. I was all prepared to, you know, walk away and say, be away for a day and not have any contact with the outside world, but for some reason they allowed me to use my iPhone, so I was pretty much tweeting and answering Facebook messages as soon as the first sort of wave of the anaesthetic wore off, and I was back in my bed in the hospital room. But
yeah, I think most of us have seen that photo, and we're not sure that was a good idea.
but I'm getting there. I took my first sort of steps out today. I'm just really slow on my feet because it's just really awkward more than anything. You don't realise how much you use your belly and your tummy muscles for. And it's just a wee bit sort of slow on my feet. And it was nice to get the fresh air. It's really helped me. There's nothing worse. Trust me, everybody I've said this to, oh, I'd love a week, you know, 4 weeks off my work, I'd love it. But trust me, there is nothing worse than sitting on your backside and doing nothing. And don't even get me started about daytime television. I'm avoiding daytime television like the plague.
Daytime television's a government conspiracy to end unemployment.
Well, I completely and totally agree with that.
The big question on everyone's mind is, has the gastric band that you had fitted under the cover of a gallbladder operation worked?
It wasn't a gastric band, it was liposuction. Ah. So it was actually liposuction and a breast reduction, that's what it was. So unfortunately, breast reduction has, I'm still a bit swollen, you know, my moobs... Sure. My moobs need to still come down, but I think the lipos actually worked reasonably well. So,
good.
But yeah, the hospital was brilliant, I have to say. It made me really proud of the NHS. I have to say that the quality of the care that I received was far and away better than business class on I think, one of the airways that I've travelled through to the States in a couple of times. The care was just first class. It was a really positive experience, albeit I'm still sore and a bit stir-crazy and a bit fed up as of yet. But how's things with you? You were at Fury at the weekend.
I was at Fury, which stands for Fellowship of United Reformed Youth. It's our youth assembly, a kind of young adult event that happens every year. And yeah, it was fine. You know, I'm still suffering from sleep deprivation, but apart from that, it was good. Good to see some of the young folks. Don't get a chance to see a lot of them very often because it's a kind of UK-wide thing. So, you know, a lot of them I only get to see once a year. So it was good to see them, good to see some of my colleagues. And also got the opportunity to go and see friends that we don't see very often who live down that way, down south of Birmingham. So, yeah, it was good to catch up with them.
That's really good. It's really good to hear that. Although I have to point out that you were there in the capacity of your job and not as because you're a young person.
Absolutely.
I think that gets you back for the comment that you said about the young folk, the ICC, knowing more about things than I do. I think that was taken as a given, but for some reason my dad likes to keep reminding me of that one. So, but yeah, I'm glad you had a good time at Fury. It's always good to connect with people.
You're listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
All right, on the phone via the wonderful world of Skype, we have Andrew Jones, a.k.a. Tall Skinny Kiwi. And despite popular belief, he is not the brother of Tony Jones. Don't let that be confusing. Some people have suggested that. But Andrew, welcome to the show today.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here. I'm much better looking than Tony Jones. There's no way we could be family.
I understand that. I'll leave that argument between the two of you, though. Now, Andrew, you are originally from New Zealand. I guess that's where the tall, skinny Kiwi comes from.
The Kiwi thing, yeah. Well, the skinny and the tall thing came later when I got taller and taller and skinnier. But I was born in New Zealand, lived when I was 17 with my family to Australia, and then I left Australia when I was 21 because I wanted to be a missionary. And I sold my car, bought a one-way ticket to overseas, and I never really came back. And I've been wandering the earth for about 25 years and picked up a wife along the way, and now I have 5 kids, and we still haven't got a real job.
I'm wondering how we can all do that route just to get away from the real job and focus on just traveling the world as you do.
Yeah, well, there's drawbacks. Of course, I don't own anything. I have no money. I don't own any property. But it's been a good ride, and I have no regrets.
Excellent. Now, growing up in New Zealand, was your family religious? Were they active in the church, or did you come about?
They weren't active at all, but they did send me to Sunday school. And mm-hmm. I went along a few times, and I heard John 3:16, and it really impacted me. And then later on, as a teenager, I ended up in one or two Christian youth groups, and I was impacted by their lives. And when I was really 15, 16, I committed my life to Jesus and got my stuff sorted out and got reoriented in the right direction and never looked back. So as a 17-year-old, I was quite wild-eyed and fiery and fundamentalist, and I became a street evangelist. And for about 3 or 4 years, I would be on the streets every week preaching the gospel, giving out tracts, scaring people into heaven, that kind of stuff. No, but yeah, to answer your question, my family weren't religious, but later on they found Jesus in their own time, and the rest of my family as well, which has really been exciting. My sisters and my brother.
Now, what was it that drew you? You said that you felt a calling into to be a missionary. What was it that drew you to that aspect of Christianity?
Well, a lot of it was sharing the gospel with people on the streets in Australia, and they had all heard the gospel before, and hearing that there were places around the world where people had never heard, not even once, and I just wanted to go to where I was needed more. And I heard about a ship that was sailing around the world called the Logos, and it sounded fantastic, and so I sold everything and flew overseas to join this ship. It got me into Latin America, and before that I was in Asia and then Europe. And I just loved it. I felt that this was the race marked out for me, and I wanted to be a Bible smuggler in Eastern Europe. And I signed up for the team, and I was going through interrogation training. This is about 1985, because I'm 45 years old now, in case you're wondering. And I got on the team, and we were learning about what to do when you get chucked in jail and everything. And this other girl wanted to get on the team too, but they sent her off to the ship. And anyway, I ended up going to the ship, met this particular girl who also wanted to go to Eastern Europe, and we fell in love and got married, and she's now my wife of 20 years. That's Deborah Cosper from California. But the funny thing is, we actually did get back to Eastern Europe. We went to Prague for 3 years, mm-hmm. and although the Iron Curtain had come down, there was still work to be done, so we got to fulfill that part of our lives as well.
Pretty interesting. Was there something that struck you through all of that, that you just really learned about God or saw God working through all of that?
Well, it's always amazing when you spend time in a church and you watch people get up and preach, and then all of a sudden you get thrown into a situation where even though you're really young, you're the one who's preaching, you're the one who's doing all this stuff. And as a 21-year-old, I found myself leading a team of people and starting a church in Austria and doing things that I didn't expect. And I guess in some ways it demystifies the whole church experience, and it makes it a bit more normal and not something that's just for the professionals, but for everybody to do, to be involved in the ministry of the gospel and to start churches and get on with the job with what you've got. So mm-hmm. Obviously when I left the mission field and came back to America in 87, we had the same mindset. You just do it. You don't wait around for permission, or you don't wait around for a big budget and lots of money or a building. You just get on with it and do it with what you've got. So I suppose that was my entry into the emerging church in the late 80s in America, where we just got on with a job and started using existing buildings for ministry and not really waiting around for all the things that we think we need sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of missionaries talk about how they go through training to learn how to do mission work or, theology and so forth. But when they get to the mission field and they're kind of thrown into ministry, it changes your perspective not only of ministry but of God and how God works in the world around you. Did you see that happening as you were in Europe?
I was lucky. I went to a very small Bible college that focused on the Bible. We studied every book of the Bible, and that kind of stuff, it sticks with you for the rest of your life, and it's training for anything. I think the problem is sometimes when you end up in a particular Bible college or seminary, you do a lot of very practical kind of courses, which seem to be really good for the next 3 or 4 years, but then culture shifts and changes, and everything you learn doesn't really apply anymore. Hmm. But it's always good to look at case studies and principles that kind of work no matter where or when. Those things seem to apply across cultures, but so much of the training these days is how to do this and how to do that, and 5 years later everything's changed and it's a completely different environment, and a lot of it's not really worth much anymore. So mm-hmm. But I was very glad to have a good grounding in the scriptures and to use that as a base. Obviously, there's more surprises. Every time you go into another context, there's new ways to look at the scriptures and certainly the ministry in front of you. But it wasn't a big shock for me at all.
Okay. Now, and you said you came back to the U.S. I guess in '87 and spent some time here in Texas
yep.
with the Baptist General Convention.
Oh no, that was much later. No, that was during the '90s. No, I wasn't with any mission. We were just I was just working in L.A. and we started a Bible study, which became kind of a churchy thing. And then I came on staff in Portland, Oregon, with a church, an Evangelical Free Church, and mm-hmm. we started a kind of a coffee shop style service in the basement, and had tables and chairs and coffee and continental breakfast and a stool and everything. And it didn't really look much like church, but it was kind of our attempt to be, a little bit more probably, well, I was going to say relevant, but less threatening, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And we did a bit of that for a number of years. I went back to Australia for another 3 years and did more youth ministry inside a church. But I think the turning point for me really was around 1993. I got a little bit fed up with doing the big, you know, attractional kind of service, getting all the young people in, doing their drama, cool kind of thing. It wore me out a little bit, and it wore people out, and I just really felt that what we needed to be doing, if we're going to fulfill the Great Commission, is to focus on multiplying movements, church planting movements that spontaneously reproduce and take over whole cities and whole countries. And I found that what we were doing wasn't really sustainable, energy-wise, resource-wise. And I just wanted to figure out. So I came back to the States, studied a bit more, and ended up in San Francisco with Street Kids on the Haight-Ashbury. And it was there, really, where we began to put some of these principles into practice, really going back to look to what Jesus told us to do and to what the Apostle Paul did, to go back to a very simple, organic way of doing church based on Luke 10, based on the Gospels, and moved away a little bit from some of the programmatic style of church that I had been, well, not just learning about, but also promoting as well. And that really was a teaching point and a turning point for us.
What was the key difference then, as you came to San Francisco and you started applying these things into your ministry? What was the key difference between what you had done growing up and maybe even in Europe versus what you were doing in San Francisco and then later on?
Well, there was a passage in Luke 10 that I just mentioned, the idea that when Jesus sends out his mission team, he tells them to go into a town to pray, and there'll be a person of peace there, and then to stay in the house and to receive hospitality. And so in a way, there's this motion that moves us out towards a place where God's already prepared to meet people that God has already prepared and to find the resources that God's already provided. And once you're there, to actually support the people in order to start a new movement. So the entire thing's always moving out away from us into where God's leading us. And it doesn't really happen in our house. It happens in their house. Mm-hmm. So this man of peace in Luke 10 or Lydia who comes to Christ and the church ends up in her house, or the Philippian jailer, you know, so many of these things end up in the people's house. You know, Matthew wants to follow Jesus and it ends up in Matthew's house. It doesn't end up in the disciples' house. So the biblical example I see is of church moving out and initiating from their house, not our house. So, I mean, the way I was trained is if you want to start a ministry, find a room, find a space, you know, rent a hall or something and do something and then invite people into your space. And that way you can control it, but it's just so different from the Jesus way in which those spaces are out there, but they belong to the people. And so anyway, that orientation towards moving out with what God is doing and taking a risk and building up leaders for the harvest and just going with them, it was something that really did work for us. We saw it happening in San Francisco. We started getting invitations around the country, going from city to city, to help similar ministries get going. This is during the mid-90s, late 90s. And other people were discovering the same thing. And it was just amazing to see how Luke chapter 10 was like all over the place. Everybody's quoting it. Everybody was reading it. And even today, you know, 10 years later, people are still referring back to Jesus' instructions to his short-term mission team, if you like. When he sent out the 72.
We've had a couple guests on our show this past year that really talked a lot about that. In fact, one of our guests works now with the BGCT and works on planting organic churches around the state. And also on his own, he does some around the country. And he's very big on that, the Luke 10 and finding that person of peace. And I think someone pointed out that it's like Eugene Peterson puts it in the message. He says, the word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. It didn't say the neighborhood came to Jesus. Jesus actually pitched his tent there in the neighborhood with the people and worked among the people and lived among them.
Yeah, and when you do that, then the church takes the shape of the culture that it's in, and you don't have to define it. You don't have to decide what kind of music or what kind of food. It's all determined for you.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you were kind of fed up at this point with the attractional, I guess, way of doing ministry, having a big event and bringing people in. What was the biggest burden for that?
Well, I didn't like myself and who I was becoming. I got I got really addicted to having the best show in town and having the largest number of youth come to my church. You know, we had hundreds involved in the ministry, and it made me look really good. I had invitations all the time on the phone, and I just found myself driving this machinery faster and harder week after week, having to do a little bit better, you know, making the drama team write new dramas every week, making the bands, you know, come up with new music, and the whole thing kind of peaked with me doing my big, wonderful Gen X-y grungy message, and I found myself tempted to manipulate people so that I could end up looking better, or the bottom line would move up, or I'd have a bigger church, or I'd get to speak to better events. And I became uglier, and I saw myself moving in the wrong direction. And I wanted to just quit that entire system and find a way where Jesus could be glorified and lifted up, and not me as the preacher. And then the other thing was that it just took so much energy to run this big Sunday night service and all the other ministries that went with it, that everybody was just, I don't know, getting burned out a little bit. And I was worried that we'd spend all our time putting on a show and not have enough time to just spend with people, you know, with life-changing questions, just spend time in discipleship, and or get out of the church and go meet people down at the pub down the road. You know, it just became a huge machine that consumed us, and I didn't like it, and I didn't like me and who I was becoming. And I just sensed that it wasn't the God was in it. I mean, yeah, it was successful, but I didn't think God was really impressed with it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you come to Texas, and through all this, you're kind of getting involved in the birthing of the Emergent Conversation. What was God doing in your life at that point?
Yeah, well, it was exciting times because we were finding other people also that were moving to a much more organic way of church, or in many cases, not even doing a worship service, but just sharing life together and forming church, doing intentional communities. And there were different movements going on in the mid-90s. There was a movement among rave kids, and we traveled with those guys for a while, and that was cool. And there were, the monastic thing, people finding new ways to live together, share life together, and transform their community out of a more monastic style rather than a church format. There was another group I hooked up with was called Young Leaders, and we were kind of helping the church understand the transition that was around us, that it wasn't just an age thing, but people were really thinking differently and would need a different approach if they were to become followers of Christ, and that was quite a lot of fun as well. Other movements, we had a Celtic-style monastery in San Francisco in the mid-90s, and we were just, I suppose, exploring some of the ways in which the Celtic believers followed Christ and lived out a very organic, fresh, artistic, spiritually charged way of following Christ without getting too institutional. So I think a lot of exploration going on during the 90s, and none of us were real clear on where things were headed, and yeah, we read a lot of books and probably sounded like a bunch of know-it-alls at times. But it was a good time. And there were things going on in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand and other countries as well. But it wasn't really until 2000 that I began hooking up to some of that. And obviously the last 8 years I've been based in Europe. I come across to the States once or twice a year. But our real focus has been in Europe and the countries connected to it. And that's been really exciting too, just to jump into to the journey of the emerging church over here. Although, you know, we're not too sure what to call it now because it is so broad, and the word emerging church, it doesn't really mean anything to some people, and it means everything to others. So, I'm not even sure if I should have been calling that.
Well, I was just going to say you've written countless people, or you and countless people have written about the death of the emergent term. Do you still kind of feel that may be the case, that maybe that term is kind of dying off and something new is coming, or?
Well, I think, it depends on how people define the term. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually a wonderful term, and I've got over 100 books on my bookshelf that are written from and about the emerging church going back to the 1960s. And it really is a term that's been used for decades and decades about the new things that God is doing, either on the mission field or in the home front. It's just the last few years, a few people came out with books and they said that the emerging church was an American thing, and now it's beginning to impact other countries. And of course, you know, you get the English and other groups that are, you know, in some ways been doing it for 20 years or longer, feeling quite offended by that. And because really, I mean, a lot of countries are impacting each other. We're learning from each other. And some countries are ahead in some things, behind in others. But it's a very international, global movement. And then I suppose some people began to think that one particular group or one or two groups were kind of dominating the whole thing. And so it just seemed better to maybe say, let's try and find a word that doesn't create so much misapprehension or so much miscommunication. And maybe there's I suppose at the time I was we were working on a global network and a global funding mechanism, and somebody said, let's call it the Emerging Church. And I was saying, well, if you call it that, there'll be some people who think it'll be run by Americans or it'll be connected to, you know, a particular American organization. And I was suggesting maybe it's not the best one to go. And then also to call it Emergent or Emerging Church, even though the word's been used for decades, there'll be some people who will assume that it's more theologically liberal than it possibly might be. And that might also be a negative thing. So then I gave a little poll on my blog, and I said, we're thinking about, you know, using this word or perhaps dumping it. What do you think? And then most people said, no, dump it. It's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the things that we're doing or other people are doing, you know, maybe 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, we could call them, you know, Emerging Church or Emergent or whatever. But the things we're doing now, no, it just doesn't fit. So mm-hmm. we decided to, for this particular project, drop it. However, the word is being used all over the place. And in fact, I was just teaching at a college about a month or so ago in England, where one of the streams of their training is called Emerging Church. And I came in to teach on Emerging Church, on the history of it. They give a Master of Arts degree in it, and they're not going to change any moment soon. So there's a lot of countries that are still using the word. And when I go into those environments, I'm quite happy to use it in the way that they understand it. Mm-hmm. But there are some countries where I don't use it because there's certain meanings attached to it. Sorry if that's confusing.
No, that makes sense.
It's really broad, and it just depends where you go and what people you're with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's been interesting for me. I guess I kind of first heard the term or became familiar with the term probably around 2003, 2004, actually reading blogs from people in the UK. I wasn't familiar with it here from the US standpoint. And my initial thoughts was, well, okay, well, this is kind of a new alternative worship, I guess, because that's what they were focused on. And, you know, things like Johnny Baker and stuff that he was doing, that's where I became more familiar with it. And then I had some friends that were in seminary here in the US that were very, you know, you don't want anything emergent. It's very liberal. It's very bad. It's, you know, all of this. It's a horrible thing. And, you know, and then there was the whole Mark Driscoll, Tony Jones, you know, kind of that difference of opinion that, you know, Mark Driscoll was emerging and there was emergent, just all these different terms, and it got really confusing. But I guess within the last year or so, I've kind of got a better handle of what's going on here in the U.S. and gotten a little bit more involved. And I think, as Phyllis Tickle said recently, anyone who is emergent never claims to be emergent, or anyone that's postmodern, they never want to be labeled as postmodern. So it's that constant struggle, I guess, of trying to find a label without labeling yourself.
That's right, yeah. And there's nothing wrong with a label. What the advantage of having a label or having somebody give you a label is that it invites criticism, which is good. We all need mm-hmm. criticism. One of the problems I think that we have, though, is that a lot of the criticism is misdirected, and therefore it's totally ignored, and it's not helpful in the slightest. And that leaves us looking for better criticism. Mm-hmm. So one of my big regrets in kind of shifting away a little bit from the emerging label is I'm not in the firing line anymore, and I'm kind of missing some of that criticism.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you travel the world, and I know you've got some plans this summer to do some more traveling and so forth in Europe, how would you see the church evolving? I know there's definitely each continent, each country probably has their own differences, but what are some of the uniquenesses of those countries in the church?
Oh, gosh. It's probably easier to talk about continents than countries. But, I would say in Europe and North America, things are kind of slow and have been for a while and are a little bit frustrating compared to what God is doing in India and China and other countries, where things are just popping like crazy and, you know, small house church movements suddenly become millions of people very, very quickly, and hundreds of thousands of churches started by young people. Just really exciting stuff that I would love to see in our countries, but it's just not happening yet, and I hope it will. But I do think the each continent is beginning to wrestle with the scriptures and with the call of Christ on their lives and how church should look and might look for their generation. And each one's coming up with different things. I was just with some of the Latin Americans a few weeks ago in England, and they have much more of a vibrant flavor to reality, probably more influenced by the charismatic movement, I suppose. And mm-hmm. I'm talking mainly about Brazilians and some of the folk that are tied into the emerging church movement around Latin America. So sometimes theirs can be a little bit flashier and a bit happier and clappier than what you'd find in the UK, for example, where you've got much more of a post-charismatic scene. A lot of younger people having already gone in and out of the charismatic movement are much more focused perhaps on something a bit more, in their opinion, honest and real and minor key rather than major key. But still a very... a very vibrant movement in its own way. Mm-hmm. And I think the Americans have done fantastically well in finding new ways to form intentional communities together. They've been doing this for many decades. But the new monastic movements in America, I think, are quite wonderful and really well-balanced and are doing a great job. And the Europeans can learn a lot from the Americans in that regard. And, the Japanese are just wonderfully simple in the kind of churches that they've been starting. Parties, really. A lot of them involved in kind of the club scene and young Japanese just forming these kind of Jesus parties where you eat and there's music and the sharing life together and conversation without all the trappings of formal Christianity. And, and around the continent, each one's just real different. The I could go country by country, but mm-hmm. I would bore the heck out of you. and I think Australians and New Zealanders have always had kind of an edge, just the ability to jump into new things and to try them out. There's much more of an experimental mindset. And I was in Australia earlier this year, and the emerging church that I was seeing in Melbourne was much more integrated with the Asian churches. And so... they're being influenced by Asia, and they're also influencing Asia, and you've got kind of two side by side, and maybe a more new traditional conservative Asian mix, and people dressing up nicely, and you've got the Australians in their shorts and messed up hair and just very, very casual, but the two working together quite nicely. So it's good to see the various continents and countries give their gifts, but I'm still waiting for something to really happen. Nothing's really taken off yet, in the what it has in India and China, maybe what's beginning to happen now in Bangladesh and in certain parts of the Muslim world where there's just really spectacular movements happening that nobody can keep track of because they're just going so quickly and so wonderfully with some fantastic miraculous signs happening and all of that. Compared to those things, I think it's kind of boring and we're just maybe holding on, maybe holding ground a little bit here in Europe and other places. But that's how I see it.
Have you done much with African churches and Christians on that continent?
Yeah, I was in South Africa last year, but I haven't really done much yet with Africa, except I meet Africans coming here to Europe, and in Germany and the UK, and sometimes I'll come and do ministry for a few years and then go back, and I love what they bring, the understanding of spiritual realities. Mm-hmm. Working with power and understanding power. And I also think they bring a very refreshing simplicity to the gospel and a new conservatism into our Christianity. And if you want to know what the emerging church is coming, you really have to look at where the church is largest in the global south and how it's impacting us, because this is really where some of the biggest changes are happening now as we interact with these different continents and countries. Mm-hmm. And what it means is obviously as the African church is beginning to influence us here in the UK, there is a new conservatism, and some people say probably I shouldn't say this, but I won't even say it. No, I'll move to the next one. I'll get in trouble for talking about an openness towards polygamy. But go ahead.
I spent just 2 weeks in Africa. in Nigeria, and it was there was an interesting kind of contrast in the churches that I visited. There were some that seemed to be very strongly influenced by traditional American church that still had the very orderly worship service. Everybody came in their best dress and so forth. And then the further away you got from the cities, the more there seemed to be a more organic experience and more sharing and openness I don't want to say a stronger faith, but they seemed to live out their faith on a more day-to-day basis sometimes. And I thought that was an interesting contrast. And you probably see that in every other continent as well. But just how the different influences affected those churches. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I really love to see churches get birthed in a country, and then they take on the identity of that country in a way that they find their redemptive gifts and their purpose, not from exporting it in from another country where they're all fascinated by, but by finding the way of Christ for them in their country, in their city, and then rising up to give their gift and to be influenced by other countries, but not to mimic them. Because it just slows everything down, and it adds a really weird element to the gospel when it has these either American or English or Korean elements to it that, you know, work well for those countries but aren't really supposed to add so much baggage to the gospel we carry.
Mm-hmm. Overall, how would you say that your view of God has changed over the last 20 to 30 years, or your view of faith and Christianity?
Well, being such a... 20, 30 years ago, being a young fundamentalist street preacher, it was all about activity, and I was quite a legalist. You know, I would be out there giving tracts at midnight and giving the Christians a hard time for going out to the movies when they should be doing evangelism. I don't see those as wasted years. I had a fantastic time and learned a lot, but I really don't think God is as concerned about how much activity we achieve for Him. You know, as He is who we are and our character and how we are walking. So I suppose I see God as being more chilled now than what I did when I was in my late teens, where, you know, God was out to, you know, save the earth on a budget quickly. And every ounce of our energy needs to be just doing. And I suppose there's a time in your ministry when you move from doing to being, or at least your activity flows out of your character, and so there is a transition, and I suppose connected to that is your view of God as a God that just wants to get everything done, to a God that's more interested in the process, and a God that loves us, and a God that can wait sometimes for His own good time rather than what we expect Him to do, which is to conform to our time. You know, when you're young, you think God's in a hurry for everything, and then when you get older, you think, well, you know, maybe I was in a hurry, but God may not be. Maybe He's just waiting for the right season for something. So,
That's good. How would you define your faith to a stranger on the street, someone that walks up and says, "What is your faith? What is your Christianity all about?"
Well, it's certainly, I often don't use the word Christian, but I am a follower of Jesus, and so my faith is linked into this man. Everything depends on Him, on the fact of Him and His birth and death and resurrection and ascension. So it's certainly Jesus-centered and Jesus-based, and not as much based on the church. I mean, it's more kingdom-centered than church-centered, you know, compared to like 20, 30 years ago where I was out to bring people into the church, which was one of my great missions. But now I want to help people, like I have done, find who they are in Christ and begin to walk out the race marked out for them by Him.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily, I wouldn't say it's any more simple than what it was 20, 30 years ago. In some ways, I'm probably less sure of my theology than I was when I was 18, 19, going through Bible college and being absolutely convinced that I was right on everything. You know, when you actually change your mind a couple of times, it loosens you up a little bit. Mm-hmm. You realize, well, you know, I was actually wrong about that, you know, 10 years ago. And if I was wrong about that, maybe I'm wrong about one or two other things as well. And so So I suppose I have a greater acceptance now for people that think differently, because I know that in another 20 years, I might think differently again.
Right.
I would hope that I still hold on to the fundamentals of the gospel, but I'm also hoping that I'll have enough wisdom, and wisdom that's been rubbing shoulders with believers from other continents and other countries as well, to help me get a better and wider perspective on the gospel. But I would hope that I would see clearer when I'm older. Mm-hmm. And see with a more of a kaleidoscope kind of a way the life of Christ and what that means for me today.
Very good. Now, we sent out some I put on Twitter that people could, if people had questions for you, to send them in. And one of the questions that came back was people were asking about your daughter's forced vaccination that happened just, I guess, a couple months ago.
Yes.
What's the fallout been from that, or what's been the response and so forth?
Well, yeah, we told our story, and the media picked it up. It was in all the national newspapers, and it made front page on a number of them. When that was done, we felt we had done what we should have, which was tell our story, and just in case there were others who went through similar stories. But nothing happened for a few weeks, and then a member of parliament, member of Scottish Parliament, picked up the story and was outraged that there actually isn't any minimal age of consent for these kinds, either these injections or anything else. And so she's actually running with it right now. And so we feel in a way that somebody else in the top end of Parliament is thinking that it's important as well, and they're making some changes. And so we felt good about, you know, what we did, and we think we're making a positive step for the country here. There weren't any more medical complications after her initial episode, so that's all faded away. We're not going ahead with any more injections, mm-hmm. on our point. So it all worked out fine.
Very good.
It was just weird that it happened to us out of all other families, and we were wondering, you know, is there a reason for this? And I think we did what we could.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Glad to hear that there was nothing further. I guess it was kind of, she had like flu-like symptoms, is that right, after the initial vaccine?
Well, she's diabetic.
Oh, that's
right.
She's
diabetic, as far as we can tell, there's never been any research done on how a diabetic would respond to this. And so we said no, and then she said no, and then they just jabbed her anyway, mm-hmm. which we thought was outrageous. And especially with an untested, what we think is untested drug, mm-hmm. and it just, you know, we did the whole system. We just really felt that we should speak out against it, which we did. Mm-hmm. But we also really encouraged people to trust their local physicians as well, and maybe get it out of the schools where it's, you know, done in private and taken away from the authority figures. Do it in conjunction with a family physician that would, you know, maybe know some of the history as well. Right. There's other issues connected to that which we didn't get into very much, to do with you know, the opportunity for abstinence teaching and other things. But that's another battle and another day.
Mm-hmm. Another question that someone asked was, what advice would you have for someone starting out in a new ministry or wanting to start a new church? What advice would you give them coming out and going into full-time ministry?
Well, I'm assuming these are questions from Americans?
This one was, yes.
Yeah. I think a lot of ministry, if you're just starting out, a lot of training has to involve unlearning some of the bad habits that we've got, and the dependency on buildings and programs and musical instruments. And, you know, I see people starting churches and they're like, yeah, we're just going to start from the very beginning, and we're going to have a service, and we're going to have this and that. They've already picked out the sound system, and they've really made so many decisions without the people. Mm-hmm. And you really have to start with the people. It's like Luke 10. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's like a box of chocolates, you know. You just don't know what you're going to get, but God knows, and you need to kind of progress that way. So there's a passage in the scriptures that I was given by a mentor of mine, Tom Wolfe from California, and it's when Paul talks to Timothy. He explains what he's done, and he gives a kind of pattern for apostolic ministry or for starting ministries, gives it to him in 1 and 2 Timothy, and he says he says in talking about prayer, he says, "So this gospel, I was appointed a herald and an apostle and a teacher." So if you look at it, there's this teaching on prayer, that we should pray for those in authority, etc. And which really is how ministry starts. It starts with prayer, with dependence on God, asking God to do something, to send laborers into his harvest, and to prepare the ground for ministry to happen. And once we've begun the prayer process, then the next phase is we become storytellers, we become heralds. Because as God begins to do things in people's lives, begins to answer their prayers, and begins to open their eyes towards him, then we get to explain that this is Jesus, you know, speaking to them, wanting a relationship with them, wanting to bring people into his kingdom. And so as people begin to respond and give their lives to Jesus, then we become apostles. We begin to throw parties and create structures and form communities out of that. And then the last phase is the teaching phase, where we begin to explain what we've done so that they can go and do something similar, that they can entrust these things to faithful people. And the process continues, and it just replicates, and it goes viral, and then it takes over the whole city. So, there's a pattern that I've seen in the life of Paul and also in our own ministry that follows those things. But another piece of advice I would have is, if you're starting a brand new church, keep Christians away from it. Because, I mean, there are some Christians that just go from church to church. You know, you start up something and they'll turn up and they'll be there for 6 months and they'll be disgruntled about their last church. But when they leave you, and they will, they'll also be disgruntled about your church. And it's best not to have them in the first place. It's good to have them if you want to build up numbers and write really good reports. But long term, just start with the people that God's bringing you to, that God's put on your heart. Start with them, and then as their family and their friends and their networks begin to come in, it just grows slowly and organically, and it's not very impressive, but it just gets bigger and bigger, and that's the way it needs to go. So yeah, Christians, keep them away, really. They're a problem. Tell them to go back to their own church.
Very good.
It's such a consumer-driven church society, isn't it? It's just ridiculous, you know? You got a better worship leader? Yeah, we'll go there. It's like, oh, no, you don't. Go back. And the other thing is, when you're starting a ministry, you need to have good relationships with the other pastors in the city. And when I was in San Francisco, I refused to allow anyone to migrate to my church from another church in the city. I would send them back. They would say, oh, we're going to come to your church now. And I'm like, no, you don't. Back you go. Don't want to see you here next week. And, yeah, we didn't grow that much at all. But the other pastors trusted me because they knew I wouldn't steal their sheep. And I think that's for the church in the city. We've got to trust each other, you know. And this whole sheep stealing thing, it's just awful. People building up numbers so they can say they have this many and they get some on the conference circuit. The whole thing sucks, in my opinion.
Right.
So just don't even go there.
Well, I have a friend that's working in Reno right now and planning to plant a church there in Reno. And he said that it's just amazing that, you know, 10% of the population would consider themselves Christian. It might even be less than that. But he said there's just a very small minority that would consider themselves Christian, and the churches are constantly fighting over that 10%. So he's basically told every pastor he comes in touch with, he says, you take the 10%, I'll take the other 90, and we'll call it even. He says, I want the people that need Jesus, the people absolutely. That already have Jesus.
Absolutely. I've even said very similar things myself in the past. You know, there's a lot of churches that are rising up now out of these people that don't go to church. And in fact, they still really don't go to church when they form these communities. It's not really like starting up a service. Mm-hmm. Some of the fastest movements that we're seeing now in the West are groups that are forming around social enterprise or networks inside the police force or other cell kind of based movements, but they're just popping up from ordinary people, and they're beginning to grow and multiply, and it's not really church people and it's not really church structures. It's something that's really happening out there in the marketplace from within, and then beginning to swell and to multiply, and it's really quite exciting. And again, it's with these 90,000 or 90% who don't go to church, who don't like the church culture, who feel manipulated when they sit on a pew and actually have a high view of church. They think it's about sharing life together, about giving yourself away completely with the people of God, and not about just turning up once or twice a week and to sit through a sermon. Mm-hmm. So, yes, and there's some good things underway. But, you know, those things, I see them as quite exciting, and I see them as very similar to the early church kind of Christianity, but they just don't make it on the radar. You know, these people don't write books, and they don't get famous, and they don't speak at conferences, and you hear about them every once in a while. You know, George Barna's talking about these millions of believers that worship this way, But when you try and look around for, you know, conferences or churches, they're really hard to find, but they are there. They just don't look like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess one last question. You mentioned on your blog about this great commission vehicle, this truck that you're converting basically into an RV. Yeah. Tell us just briefly about that and what your plans are for the next year.
Yeah. We've had lots of motorhomes and RVs. We've lived in them. We lived in a Winnebago for 2 years in America. But our last one died in Italy, and we've replaced it with a four-wheel drive motorhome. It's actually a truck, and we're going to convert it into a motorhome. And it's really high. It'll go through rivers. It'll get us to Africa. It'll get us to the Middle East, we hope. We need to fit it out. We hope to be on the road within a couple of months. We're giving up our home again, and we're going to live on the road. We're not sure how long, but it's just too much work for me to come back all the time. Mm-hmm. And so the family's coming with us. We'll homeschool again. And, we'll go to where God is moving and spend time and not have to leave early so I can get home all the time. We're looking forward to it. And you can pray for us that that we end up with enough money for diesel to get to where we need to go and for safety on the road and also for wisdom on where God's leading us, where we need to go, and the people we need to spend time with in order to raise up leaders for the harvest and the next generation of what God's going to do. So it'll be fun. We'll have special blogs that just track, you know, where our vehicle is and stay tuned.
Definitely. And I've seen the pictures here on your blog, and we'll have to definitely share a link to that. It looks like it might be a little crammed in there.
It's a mean machine. Yeah, it's a bit cramped. Yeah, we'll have some tents though too.
Oh, okay.
You know, the last couple of summers we've been traveling with our tent. We have a teepee as well, and that gets really cramped when it's just one teepee and a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, are there any books that you're reading now, or any authors that are really inspiring you?
Well, I just Wolfgang Simpson just left our home. He's been there for 3 days, and he released his book into my computer. But that's called the Starfish Manifesto. But I'm the only one in the whole world who's got it right now. So it'll come out in a few months' time. I enjoyed Karl Ruschke's book this year, Global Christ, The Great Commission Takes a Postmodern Turn. I thought that was one of the better books of the year. And I enjoyed N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope, looking at eschatology. And then I had a whole ton of books, and most of them were just boring as anything. Honestly, 40 or 50 books sent my way, and I haven't reviewed most of them because they're just pathetically boring and uninspiring, unfortunately. But those two stick out as books. I enjoyed Phyllis Tickle's book as well, The Great Emergence, and I enjoyed her perspective on the last 40 years. That was just priceless.
Very good.
How about you? Which book do you like?
Well, you know, this is kind of the first year that I've been kind of getting really involved in this emergent conversation. I think Brian McLaren's Everything Must Change was a real eye-opener for me. I thought that it was a great book that just really it kind of set the mood for the rest of the year for me. And then also reading Shane Claiborne's Jesus for President. I followed Jesus for President up with Rodney Clapp's Peculiar People. And those three books, I read them January, February, just really set the mood for this year. And it was a really, hey, you know, there are some different things out there going on that I want to be a part of. And my friends and I have talked somewhat. We've coined the phrase, I guess, heretical. I was trying to say heretic and missed my wording up. But we thought, you know, there's a lot of theological ideas out there that are exciting, that tickle my ear. They may not necessarily be true, but I hope that they're true. And so we say that those are heretical ideas. They've kind of sparked some imagination in my mind and definitely got me thinking about how we should be living differently and how our faith should play out differently. And just because we're pro-life doesn't mean that we're only about saving the unborn. We should be about saving people everywhere. And social justice has been a big thing on my radar this year. So those books have had a huge impact on that.
Right. Oh, that's great. Heretical's a great word. You may want to run it by Phyllis Tickle to see what she thinks of it.
See if she hasn't coined the phrase already. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, we do appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule and chatting with us. And if people want to follow you and follow the Tall Skinny Expedition Vehicle, they can do that at tallskinnykiwi.com. You're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, follow us as we follow Christ.
Exactly. Very good. Are there other ways that people?
Well, thanks, Jonathan. It's really good to be on your. It's really good to be on your podcast, Jonathan. Thank you for your conversation. And tallskinnykiwi.com, and we're not sure what the new one's going to be for our next adventure, but but you'll find out there.
Very good. Well, we appreciate your time, and happy holidays as we're wrapping up the holiday season, and a happy new year to you and your family as well.
You too. Happy new year. God bless.
All right. God bless.
Girl, it's like an angel's sigh when I see you walking by.
Girl, you know. Tall, skinny Kiwi, Andrew Jones. What did you think of that?
I thought it was a great interview. I really enjoyed it, actually. I listened to it twice, which is very unusual. And not because I wasn't paying attention the first time. I just thought his whole approach to mission and ministry was so refreshing. It really was, you know, this idea that it's not about poaching people from other churches. It's not about building yourself up to be the biggest church that you can be. It's about creating a place where people feel together and at home and loved by God. I mean, that just, you know, it just was so good to hear someone talking like that.
No, completely. I have to admit, I was bowled over when Jonathan was able to get the interview. Andrew Jones is one of the sort of spiritual heroes of mine. Between Andrew Jones, Johnny Baker, the stuff that Mark Berry's doing, and certainly in the UK, you know, you're talking Brian McLaren, you're talking Shane Claiborne, Rob Bell, these type of characters in the US, but certainly Andrew Jones' Tall Skinny Kiwis blog is a must-read blog, and it's just something I've got. His work is something I've really got a lot of benefit out of. And for me, he's always been the encapsulation of the idea of the apostle. You know, somebody that's going out there pioneering, looking at new opportunities, looking at new ways of expressing church, looking at new opportunities. He's very much been that sort of apostolic kind of inspiration for me. And I was really, as I say, like yourself, I've got a lot out of it. I think the first thing I would have picked out about the whole thing is that who would have thought you would have met his wife at a Bible smuggling training camp thing? I just was laughing. I have to watch. I can't laugh at the moment because of my stitches, but I just was laughing at that. You know, you just imagine these young Christians coming together to go smuggle Bibles and just happen to meet the love of their lives. It's just such a sweet story. You know, it's just this funny, you know, where did you meet? So tell me, Mr. Jones, where did you meet your wife? It's a long story, but let's just say we're both training to be Bible smugglers. Yeah, it just was awesome, you know?
It's such a great image, isn't it?
Yeah, in the interrogation section of the training, you know, you just imagine these folk with lamps in their faces and stuff like that. And you know, we're laughing. It's, you know, it's a different world, say, post-Cold War than it was when it was Cold War. And you've got to respect all the folk that put their lives on the line to do these kind of things, stuff that we take for granted.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like a kind of comedy thing to do, but it's real. And you know, there are still places around the world where, you know, the authorities don't want the Bible to be, and there are still people smuggling Bibles into countries to, you know, give people access to the Word of God. And it's not funny if you get caught.
No, by no means. But it just, there's just this funny sort of romantic kind of thing about it, you know, the whole thing. That I just imagine it. it's just so cool. But when he's talking about, you know, he's talking about his early days, about this sort of being a, you know, street evangelist, scaring people into heaven, and then getting really going on Logos with Operation Mission. Operation, is it? I can't remember OM anyway. And he's doing some of the stuff there, just really, really inspirational stuff. Starting this church in Austria, and one of the comments that really captured me that he carried on later on was this whole idea is, when he started this church in Austria, it demystified the experience that it wasn't just for professionals, but that everybody had, can and should and could do it.
Yeah.
Everybody has a part to play, so, just get on and do it. And I think that whole, I would call that whole just do it, I call that very much the punk rock ethos. It's a case of, look, we don't need the big, fancy prog rock bands doing all their crazy stuff. Let's just get up there, let's learn three chords, let's get up there, let's do it, let's make music, let's be part of the crowd. And, I definitely see that. Don't wait for permission, don't wait for loads of money, don't wait for a building, just go out there and do it. And that for me was very inspirational.
Yeah, just picking up on your last point there, don't wait for a building, I thought, again, one of the refreshing things that he was kind of talking about is that buildings are the last thing that you need. That this idea that you go somewhere and look for that person of peace that, when Jesus sends out the early missionaries.
Yes.
That's what he says, it's not go and build something, not go and take over a building, it's go and find someone to stay with that's sympathetic and build a church there,
Yes.
build a church in someone's house.
And the key thing that really got me was he's saying, look, we need to move out. And in all the examples of, the person of peace, is that it's not in our house, It's in their house.
Yeah.
And I think that's the fundamental difference. And we have all these issues of control, and we have all these issues of, it's got to be in our space and in our time and in our control. And when in fact what he's what he's saying is quite, is very, very to the point and very now, is that sense of, well, actually, it's not in our houses, we don't put it up in our house. The apostle goes to someone else's house and then lets them run it, so that apostle, that person of peace, can then move on to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And all that happens in our situation is that the person of peace creates their own space, creates their own expression, and then they become the leaders, so that the apostolic sort of giftings that have got have to transfer into other giftings. And then you have the issues that come with that kind of leadership, when in fact we should be just built, creating space and then allowing people to run with it.
Yeah.
And that for me was, that was just when he talked about Lydia, he talked about Matthew, the churches were built in their house, built from their house.
Uh-huh.
Not from, not from Peter's house or Paul's house or whoever's house, Jesus' house. It wasn't that kind of idea. It was built in the places that they were there.
Yeah.
And it's very much about the spaces belonging to the people rather than the spaces belonging to the church, capital C, hierarchical, attractional, sort of entity. It is the people. It's the people. And that house is also the living space. It's also the eating space. So suddenly there's the natural rhythms that go with the house.
Yeah.
That you follow along from that. And I think, I think when you look at that, we talk about organic, we talk about the organic approach to church. And these are definitely the definitions of that organic sort of church. We are literally talking about the natural rhythms that come from a home.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the moving on from that, he talked about the excitement around about kind of cell churches and sort of networks, even sort of growing up around about social enterprise projects and, people in a workplace who are coming together, to talk about their faith, their life, how they get through the day, and they're doing that without the institutional church. They're doing that because, they've discovered that, there's three other guys at work that, believe in God and, want to talk about it. So they meet together at lunchtime and or after work and have a chat, and that's just so exciting.
Mm, definitely. Definitely. And you consider what we do. You consider the sort of stuff that we do at our lunch hours and after the you know, after work and stuff like that. It's very much been in that spirit, in that vein of what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of capturing that, and taking it forward. We have this idea of this attractional event. You know, I'm still, you know, as part, you know, co-founder of the Deep, the work that we're doing, it's very much an attractional event, and it's more and more it's becoming, I'm becoming of the realization that my original vision was for an attractional event that was the cherry on top of the cake, and the cake was this organic sort of toing and froing sort of community, and the community is the thing that hasn't really happened, but the event has, because we're so into this event, we're so into attraction, we're so into the sizzle and the sparkle and stuff like that. And the thing is if we're being honest, people don't want that. People want truth, they want honesty, they want quality, they want authentic relationships. You know, and the thing is I'm realizing this almost every day just now. And when you look at the story of Andrew, and Andrew's talking about 1993 was the turning point when he got all worn out with the attractional events, and you know, he just wanted to see church happen in different ways through, you know, talking about the sort of the multiplying church planting movements, this spontaneous reproducing that takes over whole cities, that is sustainable, that is very organic. You know, the talks, an example being Street Kids and Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. Uh-huh. You know, and you think, well, that's why, you know, Andrew is such a pioneer. That's why he's such an inspiration, is because he is, you know, he's already done the sort of things that we're looking at, we're going through, and that's why he is, you know, an inspiration. You know, that because of that experience, because he's lived these kind of things out, he's come to a realization that things are different, and that for me is very, very, very valuable. You know.
Sure. What else stood out from the interview for you?
Well, What really got me was the honesty of Andrew. There's a couple other things I'm going to talk about. What really got to me, I'm talking about this turning point, this 1993's turning point, where he realises, look, it's no longer about attraction, he gets burnt out. But he also talks about the fact that he doesn't like who he is.
Uh-huh.
And he gets caught up in this cycle of trying to get as many numbers. It's all about numbers. It's all about quantity. It's all about being on the conference circuit. It's all about all the things that glorify the individual,
uh-huh,
but not necessarily glorify Jesus. You know, there's too much time put on the show. There's too much time put on making an effort. And there's not enough time being with people. There's not enough time sort of spending with individuals. And that's one of the things with Deep that I've always said is look, we need to program in time for nothing.
Uh-huh.
So that we can all be with people, that we can all engage with people. And that is, to be fair, one of the successes of that. But when you consider that, you know, it was such a success, and in Andrew's words, he was talking about it being a success, but he wasn't entirely sure that God was impressed with it.
Uh-huh.
And that for me is something, you know, it's something I've known, I've got to know over the last few while. It's not about the attractional, not about that kind of thing. It's about who we are as people, you know. And he talks about the ideas of sort of moving from a activity and legalism towards a character driven who we are as people in Jesus.
Uh-huh.
You know, moving from doing to being. You know, and the fact that our activity flows from our character, that really, you know, that really was confirmation for me for a lot of the sort of stuff that I've been thinking and talking about over the last wee while, that it's not what we do, it's who we are that counts. You know, and we expect God, you know, God to be in a hurry. God is demanding. You know, but maybe God's actually biding his time. Maybe it's us that have got to get in alignment with his time.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, the other thing sort of coming, you know, was the last couple of points that was made. You know, Andrew talked about the whole vaccination story of his daughter.
Uh-huh.
And this was one of the things I followed in his blog really closely, because being, you know, we're both in Scotland, I'm, you know, Motherwell and you're Hamilton.
Yeah.
this whole thing just really, really shocked me. I've got two girls, so that kind of thing is going to happen at some point in the future with me, and I was just really, really shocked about it. But the one question that Andrew talks about is, he says, is there a reason for this? And I think, to be honest, the way that both Andrew and Debbie have handled the situation was just so gracious. So, don't get me wrong, they're extremely assertive of what they did. Uh-huh. But they handled it in such a way that it was just was really, really loving. And, there's a nice way that they went about it. So when they talk about, was there a reason it happened to us and our daughter? Well, I'm just thinking, yes, because you guys know how to actually do it right. You know how to go against the system, go against, rebel against the system, but in such a way that actually was done in a gracious way that upheld kingdom values. Uh-huh. And the other point, the last point, when he was talking about the whole pattern of church planting, uh-huh. He talked about prayer, heralding, storytelling, and then apostles and teaching. That whole idea that we pray for a situation, pray for the space, and ask the Lord, look, we want to join you with you, Lord, in this. Uh-huh. And then the heralds become, those people become heralds. They start telling stories, explaining to people what, who and what's happening and who Jesus is. And then the apostle element comes in and they form communities and help them to form communities. And then the teaching is explaining about what's happened and explaining who this Jesus is. And all that kind of, that really, really helped me. Been thinking... I've been working with a few friends for a while at looking at a coffee house that we've got space in the sort of Trongate area of Glasgow. Uh-huh. And one of the things that I've been said to them is I think what we need to do is we need to go in and start with prayer. And this really vindicated me, this Paul pattern that Andrew spoke about. He talked about Paul's sort of pattern really vindicated that idea. That we don't go in saying, look, this is church, that we'll just replicate what church is. What we do is we go in and we try to find through prayer what the Lord wants us to do. I strongly believe that the Lord wants us to be in this space. So, okay, Lord, where do you want us to be? What do you want us to do next? And then start with heralding, start with, building up the community, start with the teaching. And that really helped me in that sense. That really gave me, shaped the ideas that will flow from that. So that was really, really encouraging. And then the last point, I don't know if you laughed at this, but when he was talking about how if you're starting to plant a church, keep other Christians away from it. Yeah. Keep disgruntled Christians. I just thought, this guy knows my situation so well. This guy knows what's happening,
I think it's so true. I love the thought of him sending back people. Church, don't come here because you're fed up or you're falling out with somebody or you want to try something new. I often wonder how many people have left church because it's easier to leave than it is to stay.
Yes.
And that sometimes we get so much more out of the difficult than the easy times. It's always, I guess we can look back and say, oh, that was a great time, but we always also look back and say that was a really difficult time, but it was worthwhile. It was worth sticking with it. We grew so much more because we weathered that particular storm, or partly what he does is I suppose he's creating space for people who haven't been infected, if you like, by that kind of the kind of negativity that sometimes comes into church and to people mm-hmm. who have left a church. There's a kind of sense of disgruntled negativity. So creating a safe space for people who haven't had that is really important. But also, sending those folk back and saying, look, go and work it out.
Right.
Go and stick it out and see how you get on. Sometimes folk have to move on, and that's fair enough. I think there comes a time sometimes when people need to just step out and go somewhere new or try something different. But, I think for what he's talking about, this group of new people who are coming fresh to faith, that, it's really important for them that there's a bit of protected space for them to be able to grow and to bond and to discover at the same kind of speed.
No, definitely. I think there's a need to protect people from, you know, at times from that sort of dissatisfaction. I think sometimes we can either shape things by what it is or what it isn't. Uh-huh. And the problem is I think sometimes we end up shaping things by what it isn't. It isn't like my old church, it isn't like this church, it isn't like that. But sometimes what we should be doing is shaping it by what it is. It's a community based on self-sacrifice, where we're all interested in each other, that sort of selflessness and these kind of things. And I think, you know, because one of the concerns I've got with the stuff that I'm, you know, looking to do in Glasgow is that what I don't want it to do is become a rehab group for all the burnt out people just like me from my particular denomination.
Yeah.
And it would be quite easy to become that because my name's part of it, or the folk that I'm working with names are part of it, and suddenly people catch wind of it and it becomes something that it's not. And sometimes I think we need to be very careful. And I think we also need to be very careful because what we don't want to do is create something that mimics or copies something else. When Andrew's talking about the stuff that's happening in the various parts of the world, you know, you want the church to become what it is, you know, shape its own self within the culture. Excuse me. Within the culture of the place and the space that they're in, not for it to become some sort of facsimile of where it was, you know, where it's come from. And I think by protecting it, by creating space where you sort of, you know, you get rid of these disgruntled sort of consumer Christians, and I think you have a tendency to protect those new seeds from some of the baggage that we bring, some of the malcontent that we all have, you know, all the things that we just don't quite agree with. You know, and let people experience it in fresh eyes. And if for some reason it becomes the same things that they're disgruntled with, then fair dues. But if not, you know, so be it, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, I have to say, just it was a really, really good interview, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I look forward to hearing more of Andrew's journey as he packs up this big motorhome and he heads off into... Where was he talking about? Europe and Africa and...
Africa and through to the Middle East, hopefully.
Which is awesome. I think one thing, if Andrew listens to this, one thing you should do is set up a diesel account, because I think there'd be a few people that would happily contribute to a bit of diesel to see to see him and his family get out there and make stuff happen, you know? So, that's that. So yes, thank you for the call, Stuart. Thanks to JD, who no doubt will be listening, who will be scrutinising every second of our recorded audio.
I'm sure he'll be editing every second of our recorded audio.
Yeah.
This will end up as a 3-minute conversation.
Yeah, well, let's be honest, Stuart, he hasn't been able to do it with me so far. So I figure it must be me, you know, so... But no, thanks to JD for for making the interview happen and for his tremendous production values. And but thank you for your time, Stuart.
You're welcome. Always good to speak to you. Glad you're getting better.
Well, it won't be long until we're back at Starbucks catching up with coffees, you know.
Excellent.
So that's me. Thank you very much. And I will bid everyone adieu. Until next week with the Something Beautiful podcast.
We may be little insignificant in the eyes of this world, but when we realize that God has sent us to the world as blessed, our lives will multiply and grow to fill the need. other, Lord, who can we be? We are given.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Now, is there anything before we get started, anything that you want to try and avoid or stay away from?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I've got a cup of tea in my left hand because I've got this Skype microphone covering the right side of my face. If I lift up my cup of tea with my right hand, I'm going to knock it and spill it all over me. So I'm going to really avoid drinking my tea with my right hand.